Good morning. Vice Mayor Summers, I'll be running the meeting for Mayor Smith, who is out of town. He is attending a conference of mayors event, helping to run a charrette for another city and looking at the possibility of bringing one back. So he's off doing the city's business. First order of business for today, we will go over the agenda. Dave, are you ready?
I'm ready.
It always seems to be Dave.
It always is Dave.
Items 1 through C3, anything? 3D through 3G. Also, we'll come back. Councilwoman Higgins is running a little bit late, so if she has an issue, we might have to pop that.
A quick question on, where'd it go? 3G, real quick. I just kind of want to know the difference between a refrigerator and a temperature-controlled locking drug cabinet. And why 5 temperature-controlled locking drug cabinets cost $32,000 and I can go get a fridge and throw a padlock on it and keep my kids out of it pretty easy. It's all yours.
Okay. Mr. Vice Mayor, Council Members. Councilmember Richens, these are basically small refrigerators that we keep on the truck. They have to be powered through the truck's electrical system, and they're very specific, very compact, and very secure. We keep our drugs and stuff inside of those.
That's the key difference, is they're specialized for, okay, mobile. They have to be powered, like, how do they get powered through the...
They get powered through the truck's electrical system.
How do they, get, like, when you guys stop at a station, or do you
when
guys
we're at have the, to when we're it? At the fire stations, basically we have an electrical cord that we plug into the trucks.
Okay.
The trucks always have power going through them.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Okay.
Councilwoman Higgins, anything through 1 through 3G? We just went over the fire department refrigerators, I think is now what we're going to call them.
You know, I do have something.
Very well.
On item 3E, it wasn't too far off. Anyone ask any, was there any questions on that?
No, ma'am, there wasn't.
Okay, this is one of those ongoing, I guess I'll call it a pet peeve, or a non-understanding, how's that? 36 people downloaded the bid, only one responsive bidder. So I just don't get, is this one of those high-tech things that only one company in the world can manufacture, so we only get one bidder, or is it... No one else, you know, I don't know, it's very odd. So, one of those things that continues to show up.
Councilman Higgins and Vice Mayor Summers and Council. That's something we have no control over. Procurement sends out the invitation for bids to specific people that our users come up with, you know, the people that want the item. We send it out to people that they come up with. We put it out on BidNet, where the whole world can look at it. And sometimes they're just specialized items that not very many manufacturers make.
So is it possible that it's just so strict of requirements that there is only one you want, and then the bid process is just like paperwork? That's the question there.
I think in this case we need to get the user to address that.
Okay, we don't have to go through that now. But that's just an in general statement. We can talk about that later. Thank you.
Thanks, Vice Mayor.
Absolutely. Item 3H through 3J.
Vice Mayor, we would like to actually make a presentation on the items related to 3J and 3K, but maybe we can go through the agenda and then come back to that. There's a fairly significant amount of dollars the city's receiving to improve our traffic system, so we'd like to just kind of present that to the council, talk kind of general more what that's all about. I know just the appropriate time to make that presentation, but we're ready to make a presentation on that today.
We'll fly through the rest of this first and then come back. So we'll come back to 3J, 3K at the end. Speaking of 3K through 3M. Is this my hallelujah moment on 3M?
Yeah.
3M is Fire Station 219, awarding the bid, the contractor. It looks like D.L. Withers Construction.
Would you like to see a picture?
Do you have one?
Do we have one? Why don't you throw a few of them up here for the council to see?
This project started, I think, January of last year, excluding the bond election that happened the year before that.
It is a federally funded or partially federally funded program.
No, it was partially federally funded through FEMA, which explains why it took so long. I shouldn't say that. I'm on the response team.
Well, and it is.
We're a heck of a lot faster.
And we do appreciate their funds.
We love them. Every time I go down there.
A little longer, but that's okay. Kelly, you want to just kind of go over what we...
Sure. Good morning. I'm Kelly Jensen. I'm filling in for Beth today. She's out of town. This is Fire Station 219 on Signal Butte and Elliott. If you look over here, this is Signal Butte. And so this is facing east. That's an overview, shows the parking and the access drive. Over here will be a, well, eventually this will go through. We're looking at doing some other improvements on that property in the future. So this access drive may actually go through in the future, but for now it will be gated off.
Is that for the water?
Well, not only that, but it would access, Kelly, help me if I'm mistaken, that this actually would access the property behind the treatment plant, that we've talked about the possibility in the future for park, open space park, maybe soccer or open space area. So anticipating that maybe down the road that could happen, I think that's what this access is for. Yes. So it could provide for parking maybe behind the fire station or access back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why we've kind of built it this way, looking forward to the future. So
gives us more options in the future for access to that property. That's correct.
Well, the tie-up at FEMA was concerns over flooding. So where's the boat dock? No boat dock? There's a
no
surprise.
Boat dock. Yeah.
So what did we end up having to do with this? We had to raise the elevation a foot or something?
Yeah, we did have to raise the elevation. Some of the funding for this project came from FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Right.
And so there was a lot of conditions with that funding, and that's what took us an extra year to get through that whole design process. We had to raise the elevation of the fire station by about a half a foot.
I'm picking on FEMA, but the city manager is right. Because of the funding that we received from FEMA, we're going to be able to add Fire Station 220, which will probably be awarded fairly soon. So the downside was it was delayed at least a year to get this open to meet all their requirements. The good news is that we're going to have another facility built in Central Mesa in Councilwoman Higgins district, which will also serve mine. It's right on the border.
Yep.
So that's the good news.
Yep, correct. We're looking at releasing that one hopefully next month to bid, Fire Station 220.
Well, that's right.
There's just a couple of other elevations that are looking. Can we get both those in the same view? There we go.
There we go.
So, again, looking east, these are the bays, the three bays for the station, and the front elevation.
How long do we plan for construction? A year?
Construction's about 9 to 10 months.
9 to 10 months.
All right. And this is the same contractor who built our last fire station, did an awesome job.
D.L. Withers?
Yep, D.L. Withers. We have a lot of confidence that they'll get it done on schedule, do a good job for us. Here's some other elevations, just kind of 3D renderings.
Arizona. Got anything?
What's nice, you mentioned about Fire Station 218 and now 219. Same contractor, no Taj Mahals, but very good, solid stations that are going to last for decades and decades. I think the citizens would appreciate that we're trying to use a model that we don't reinvent the wheel every time we build a fire station, and we're doing quality without having to do gold inlay granite or anything like that. So I really appreciate how that's coming out, and it's fun to be able to turn around and tell the citizens the good things of what's happening here. So.
Yeah, correct. We're trying to use the same floor plan and just tie the elevations into the surrounding area to make them fit the best we can with adjacent properties and in the areas.
So it becomes more of a site issue. Site conditions, we're working on that to make it work. So. Thanks, Kelly.
Okay.
This area is kind of hanging out there on the far west side. There's no backup out there, and it's been without a fire station. This is what happens when growth gets ahead of the city infrastructure. And that's going to happen more and more thanks to impact fees, which we won't get into that. We'll leave that to the mayor. Item number 4 through 6A. You have something, sir?
Yeah, I've heard about $3.
I'm on 3L real quick.
Yep.
Is Parks here? Parks.
Yes.
Park.
Park. 3L, sorry. Item 3L.
Kleinman Park.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to confirm. There's been some talk about some renovations in a more comprehensive way at Kleinman Park, and I just wanted to – I didn't know where the basketball courts were located at Kleinman Park and if they were going to be within the area where we've talked about.
No. I'm Andrea Moore from Parks and Recreation Commercial Facilities. The basketball courts are in the northwest corner of the park. There's a little parking lot that's just north of – there's a church – on the west side of the park,
yeah.
And the basketball courts are tucked right up in that corner.
Okay.
So it's out of the way of any other ideas we've discussed for renovating the rest of the park.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
And Councilmember and Vice Mayor Councilmember, we assured that we talked a lot about this staff. We do get a lot of usage out of those courts. They are in need of renovation. So we're trying to, you know, slowly go around the city and make these renovations so they can still be used. And we got some good feedback from the park rangers that they do see that this gets used and this would be a worthwhile investment. So thanks, Andrea.
Anything else on that page?
How about 4 through 6A? Housekeeping issue, Linda, on 5C, it's District 5. Z11-04 is companion to A0816. It's District 5.
Okay, get that.
I got you this time. 6B through 9E. Anything there?
And again, Vice Mayor, we also have a presentation because this is Council's coming back to Council, the CDBG home and ESG. Now, it's what you had seen previously, gone back out, and then was sent back out to the comment period. We thought maybe today, at appropriate time, kind of give you an update where what's happening as far as the impact with the federal budget, the impact will have on this recommendation. So would you like us to do that now?
What we'll do is we'll finish this, and then we'll go back.
So we're prepared to do that today.
Right. Okay. So we'll have three items to readdress, if that's okay with everyone.
Yep.
Yeah. So anything else on that page 7? Page 8, 9F through adjournment? No? Mr. Brady, you want to go back to those three items?
Dan, why don't you come forward and cover the items you had, and then Tammy, then we'll have Tammy come up after that.
Good morning, Vice Mayor and Council.
3J and 3K.
I'm Dan Clevenger, Transportation Department. I asked Alan Sanderson and Derek Bailey to come up with me. It's a pleasure to come up and give you some good news. In 2008, we voters passed a bond election, which included some $10 million for ITS, or Intelligent Transportation System, projects. That didn't stop staff from continuing to look for additional funding. We've been very successful the past several years. We've been able to extend the bond dollars in doing that. On your agenda today, items 3J and 3K are two such ITS projects, which will allow us to expand our ITS communications network. It's going to include fiber optics, video detection, closed circuit TV for traffic monitoring, and other electronic equipment. You'll note in there those two projects together include $3 million in federal funds with absolutely no local match. We're very excited about that. I'd like to commend Derek Bailey. Derek's in charge of ITS for the city. I'd like to commend him and his staff for continuing to work and find additional money. And the reason we're able to do this is we spent a lot of time in the last 5-6 years developing a communications master plan, a strategic plan, and a deployment plan for ITS. That allowed us to stack up projects, very worthwhile projects to do, and just kind of wait for that funding. So by way of the bond election and securing federal funding, we've been able to get a lot of work out, and a lot of credit goes to Beth Huning and the engineering staff as well. They help us design these projects and get them constructed, and they do a great job for us. Alan?
Dan just said what I was planning to say, so I'll turn it over to Derek to just briefly go over the individual projects.
Thanks, Dan and Alan. These two projects have some similarities. The ITS East Loop deployment project It's devices only. There's no ground disturbance. A couple highlights include 28 closed-circuit TV cameras, which we use to monitor traffic back at our transportation management center. You'll recognize these cameras. They're typically installed on the tall traffic signal poles on the corners of intersections. They have smoke domes on the bottom. Also included in this project is 13 video detection systems. These systems used to detect the presence of vehicles, and it gives us more flexibility with our traffic signal timing. You'll recognize these cameras because they're typically mounted on the ends of traffic signal mast arms on risers pointed back across the intersection. 4B is similar, also includes CCTV cameras, video detection system, includes 11 miles of fiber optic cable, which we use to communicate with the devices at the intersection from the Transportation Management Center. Also included in this project are 29 traffic signal controller cabinets. Those are the big aluminum cabinets on the corners that contain our equipment. 36 traffic signal controllers and 24 intersections are being rewired. Those three items are significant because these are items that we'd otherwise be having to spend money, operations money, on maintaining and upgrading equipment at these intersections, and we're able to include it in this fully funded project. This is the location of the 4B project in red. 4A is in blue, just above the red area in Southwest Mesa. 4A is under construction right now. This map shows our CCTV camera locations after these projects will be complete. You'll notice along Brown Road there's a bit of a gap in our coverage. That's phase five. That'll be under construction in about a year, and that's our last major phase. Just to highlight, in the last couple years, we've had six projects that include federally funds. The original project estimates on those six projects was over $9 million, and we've secured federal funding on all of them. And because of that, there's no local match, 100% federally funded. Any questions?
Yeah, you may clap.
It's already committed funding. It's part of. It's budgeted and all set.
It's set.
It was once local.
Yes. It's come back to us.
Yeah.
How's that?
It was my money. It went
on our investment.
To the federal. Now it's coming back to us. That's a good way to put it.
It's a different form. That's right.
Didn't have to raise any of those traffic lights above a non-existent floodplain like the firehouse, did you? Okay. I just wondered. Because, you know, those federal dollars are a little.
This is good news.
This is very good news.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Appreciate it. This is good. This is great work. This is make a big difference in traffic flow around the city. So, all right. Yep, there she is. Come on, Jimmy.
And our last item?
Let me figure this out real
Not
quick.
Not our last item, but our last agenda presentation, yeah.
I know. I think I got it. There we go. Okay.
Speaking
Good
of
morning, Vice funding. Mayor, Council members. I just wanted to give you a quick update on where we are with this plan. This is the annual action plan for the CDBG home and ESG funding. The plan is due to HUD by May 16th. The plan was started several months ago, so it's based on the assumption that we would get the same allocation as we did last year. We know that is not going to happen. However, HUD has still not given us our final allocations. So what we did in the plan is it outlines how we might deal with the reductions. And that is through either using the priority list that was already established by the Housing Advisory Board or doing a proration on all of the across the board or a combination. I'm missing a slide there. 2 days ago, though, we did get a notice from HUD that this is their estimates of what we're going to get. It is still not our final allocation, but it shows about a 16% cut in CDBG, 11% in home, but an increase in our ESG. ESG is a very small grant to begin with, so it's about a $60,000 increase. But that program also requires the city to do 100% match, so we still have to work through some of those details. What we propose is... why this is in front of you is we're hoping to get approval to submit the plan to HUD so we can hit our deadline. As soon as we get our final allocations, we'll be back in front of you with an amendment to the plan outlining how we can take care of some of these reductions. We do have some prior year reserves, Part of the amendment that will be coming to you is to, with a goal of keeping our subrecipients whole per the plan, all except for our public service agencies. We do have a required 15% cap on the public service agencies, so they will have a small reduction. Part of the problem we know right now is we do know we have enough in our prior year.
Let me interrupt you there for a minute. Why don't you say what some of those public service agencies are? Because
I did not bring the plan with me. I think they were, there are a lot of the agencies that we also fund elsewhere, but it's when they're providing counseling. It's more service oriented as opposed to project oriented.
So not included in there? Economic development's not included in there?
No.
Projects aren't included in there, but it's providing a service. And already, even today, that's always capped at 15% of the total allocation.
Well, these are folks who deal with poverty and emergencies, yep. And the folks at the police and fire department and EMS services rely upon to child crisis services, perhaps? Might be one of them. So that these are the folks that we as a city rely upon, our emergency services, to form a bridge between what's an emergency and what's urgent. So, I mean, this is a pretty...
Yeah, the difficulty is while we can make... We're still capped as when they reduce the total amount of our allocation by 15%, that becomes the new base by which we can only allocate 15% off of 3.1 million or whatever the new number is. And we can't make up for that, even though we have some savings from unspent dollars from other programs or program income, which we think we could make us whole in the other projects. We're limited here by federal rules to only go to 15% of the new number.
You want to say something, Dave?
Yeah, I think I'd feel a lot more comfortable if we're gonna have to make a reduction from 3.7 million to 3.1, that we come back in our committee process, which worked really well in the allocations, and talk about that and let the council take it on us what cuts that we're going to make. I mean, we'll show the leadership there. And
So what we have to do procedurally to meet our May 16th? What was the deadline?
May 16th
deadline. The council still has to approve the plan that's in front of you, right? But we know, right, that we're going to have to come right back around with an amendment to that plan because of the reductions that's going to take place. But we have to play by the federal rules. So we'll come in on Monday, ask the council to approve the plan that you've already seen, okay? And then Tammy will get the word from HUD when they give us our final number, correct?
Yes.
And then we'll come, and maybe at your recommendation then, we would go back to the committee?
Yeah, that's do we have the time? Do we have time for that?
Actually, we would, as staff, want to do that as well. We would outline our recommendation.
I definitely don't want
to
do it.
We do have the time, because what will happen is this plan is approved, so they can start spending that money, but we will be amending it prior to them ever getting to the point where they would run into that issue. Yeah. So we have the time, and we would want to do that as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an awkward thing. We're asking you to approve something that we know we're going to come right back into amend, but we need to get that approval done.
It's called budgeting.
Anyway, so we just want to give you a heads up on that. The good news to a certain degree is that outside of the public service grouping, we believe we have enough savings from prior years that have been rolled forward that we can make all the other projects whole for this year. Now, next year when we go through that exercise, that'll be different. But it's just that one group that we're capped at. So.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea, some of those agencies, most of them, well, I can read off some names, but basically it's legal service, foreclosure education and counseling, case management. So it's very service oriented on the public service agencies.
But that would be a good discussion with the committee. We can bring back.
Yeah.
So the only other issue that we have to deal with is.
I'm sorry. Just a quick question. When we talked about. We have a little pot of money that we give that we just recently talked about giving. Can't remember
ABC dollars.
Yeah, ABC, and then we have some general fund in there.
Well, that, that is
that we give to the social service agencies, and we talked about we might be getting a little bit more money in there. Is that money that we could use to like fund these projects to make them whole?
We're checking into a couple things.
Because I know we had a hierarchy of agencies that we'd go down from there, but if we could keep an existing project whole and then...
If we do get more ESG money, what we do right now is we use that money as our match. So I've got, we're researching with HUD right now, can we fund some of these other programs and still call it a match? Or do we have to take, if we get a lot of 209, do we have to have 209 to those agencies that are providing those that we have done the given the ESG grant to? We still might have extra, but we're looking at that possibility. So we will definitely be coming to you if we have extras and say, here's, we found another pot, we can make them whole as well. What we cannot use the money for, prior year money, is we cannot use it to fund our administration. So our administration will be absorbing an 18% cut, or a 16% cut and 11% cut.
Right. So we'll be bringing, we'll be having to process some reductions in our workforce in that area because of that, too.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Okay. Just want to give you a heads up on that before Monday.
All right. I just want to, I can't let Tammy step away without praising her. That, I mean, she has her ducks in a row. She's prepared again. And I just really appreciate that. It gives me a lot of confidence. So
thanks, Tammy.
Thanks, Tammy.
All right. Moving on. Item 2A, presentation, discuss, provide direction on development and sustainability department. I think this is a continuation of a previous meeting.
Just one big long.
Good morning, Vice Mayor, Council Members. I'm Christine Zalanka, Director of the Development and Sustainability Department. I have Scott Boucher here today, the Environmental and Sustainability Deputy Director. Other members of the management team of the department, obviously John Wesley, our Planning Director, and Beth Huser-Nellis and Steve Heather, who are in the audience and will help me if I need help. That are deputy directors for the department. Just wanted to briefly review our vision and goal of building a better Mesa. Really does start with our department, and we continue to be committed to that concept. I wanted to briefly review the organizational structure of our ever-evolving department. We basically have four work areas, the planning and entitlement area that's managed by John. Under development planning, we have civil plan review and development coordination, which is managed by Beth Huser-Nellis. Under development services, we have code compliance, which is a new function for us. We've had for about 2 years now. Building plan review and building inspections, which are managed by Steve Heather, and then permit services, which are currently managed by, also by Beth. And then we have environmental and sustainability. Thought it would be helpful to just look a little bit at our budget history. Obviously, our department is directly tied to the health of the economy. In fiscal year 08-09, we had 114.7 full-time equivalent staff members. That went down to 59 in 09-10, which actually included taking on 9 code officers at that point. For fiscal year 11-12, we're actually recommending reduction of 2 currently vacant FTE positions, but we've added 1 environmental technician because of environmental compliance requirements on our stormwater permit, and we've added a temporary half-time FTE to help manage our stimulus program, which we'll talk briefly about. Our proposed reductions, as I said, we currently have 1 vacant building inspector position and 1 admin support assistant. We're recommending that those 2 positions be eliminated. Again, they're currently vacant, so that's relatively easy. We also reclassified 2 vacant plans examiner positions down to a lower level development information specialist. And we actually think this is going to be a significant increase in customer service. The DISers, as we call them, will be down in our permitting area. They can do over-the-counter review for simple types of plans, swimming pools, Arizona rooms. They can do simple resubmittals on red lines coming in for second and third reviews. This is something that has been one of my goals for the last 3 years, to really try to get that over-the-counter service back. I think it'll have two major benefits to our customers. Number one, the easy stuff can get in and out quickly, and it will also free up staff time. The more senior plans examiners that work on the complicated projects, it'll get the simple projects out of the queue and should really help with the turnaround time on the more complex projects. So we're real excited about that, and actually ends up resulting in a savings because we've downgraded those two positions.
That, your fourth slide on the budget history, I think, really goes to illustrate the extent of the economic downturn. I mean, we knew the housing market was hit, and your office deals with housing and growth, and mm-hmm. to go from an $11.7 million budget to just under six, and 114 employees to 59, just that's an ouch, if there ever was one.
Right.
So, anyway.
And we continue to identify ways to make ourselves more efficient, but try to really maintain that high level of customer service. That continues to be our primary objective.
Yeah, customer service reps, DIS, I don't know. That's DIS, got
Development Information Specialist.
Yeah, we're here to DIS the customers.
No, actually call them DISers, not DISers.
Yeah, in front of council you do. I'm one of the...
Beth can verify that. They're DISers. Actually, it's a great position. They do a great job.
If you could call one of our committees the TIC committee.
We actually like that.
Yeah. What was the other one?
Anyway, moving on. One of the things I wanted to...
Good luck.
That I want... Yeah, I know. Where's the mayor?
You think that's going to get you out of here faster?
I would like to withdraw that comment.
It's okay. We've been thinking that since 7:30, so it's okay.
Anyway, one of the things that I'd like to call... Start again. I would like to highlight one of the sort of special programs. Scott has been managing $4.2 million in energy efficient grant. That's a one-time allocation that actually we've spread over 3 years. We started out with $4.2 million on that. We've currently drawn down approximately $1.3 million, have an amount remaining of $2.8 million that will be spent over approximately the next year. Scott's been here a couple of times, but I wanted to highlight some of those projects. The Central Main Street Plan and the form-based code are one of the major projects, and actually we have a workshop this evening at 6:30 on the form-based code, and our consultants will be here all day today. So if you'd like to stop in and talk to the form-based code consultants, they'll be down in room 170 and you can go in and talk to them all day. It's really exciting the progress that they've made. We also work with transportation on the streetlight replacement projects. We've had several re-roofing projects that Scott has worked with our facilities department. We've got the solar installation out the CAP plant that we've had the groundbreaking on, and that's moving forward. And Scott is also overseeing the energy audits of all the city buildings. I wanted to move on to just a quick overview on some of the fee recommendations that you'll see coming forward. In the planning area, we have a few cleanup kinds of fees, wording changes, that kind of thing, nothing major. We actually have a couple of new fees that we're very excited about that are going to come forward as a result of the zoning code update. We have a new process for infill development where a relatively small site can actually come in, write their own code, create unique development standards. Obviously, that's going to take more time from staff working with developer, but we have a fee to allow us to do that, which we think will really improve the possibilities of redevelopment in some of our infill areas. We also have new processes for shared parking, which is something that our development community has been asking for a long time, and also alternative landscape plans. So those will all come forward as a result of some of the innovations in the new zoning code. In the development services area, I actually have three issues that I'd like some direction on, if possible. One of the issues that came up was a discussion on eliminating the single residence unauthorized construction fee, and we've actually worked with the subcommittee, and they determined they didn't want to recommend that, so we're recommending no change in that fee. However, there is a $220 appeals fee for single residence development if they're appealing a decision of the building official. And there was some discussion that there ought to be a lower fee for single residents as opposed to commercial fees. So we're looking for direction on whether or not you'd like to see that that particular fee reduced so that it's lower for single residents compared to commercial development.
Alex, did you want to?
What came out of committee, and it was a 2-1 vote, if we talk about eliminating the single resident building board of appeals fee, is we had one isolated incident where a resident felt like the $220 fee was a hurdle to overcome to be able to get a review by peer citizens to see if you had a legitimate issue or not, and without getting into it. Hopefully the goal was to send a message. You go through a system. If you feel like you need your peers, citizens, to review an issue, that we shouldn't have, at least on a very limited basis, some sort of fees that would cause you to, or cause anybody to have some concern that they wouldn't get a full and fair hearing. And that comes from originally we're trying to do as much cost recovery as we can through building and sustainability. This is such an isolated use. In fact, we don't think there'd probably be one in a year.
There's very, very few.
Very few. But I think as a committee, we said, let's look at that for a year. If we have this massive influx of folks that suddenly want to, start impacting the system, then we may have to reconsider it. So that was the one key point that it was a recommendation came from the committee for the full council to look at to see if we support, at least in that particular instance, eliminating that one fee. What was nice on the first bullet point that's here is throughout the city, we often have folks that build without permits and kind of illegal building, and there has to be a disincentive or a penalty. And so I support the staff's recommendation, and I think the committee did also, that it's only about $30,000 a year, but if there has to be something there, if people do this, they have to realize there's a penalty. If we were to take that away, then we may have some, people would challenge that system and then have no penalty. And, so it's not to the advantage of the overall citizens. So, and then one that came from Ms. Salonka, and I appreciate her leadership on all of this, is the appeals for what used to be TIC or whatever we're calling it now. It's their recommendation that we drop that from $1,500 to $500 for more of the single resident. These are folks that don't play the system. They're just trying to do what they need to do on a very small basis. And I think we supported that as a committee, that that recommendation. So that's the little bit of background.
Yeah, I think that covered it pretty well. So the direction you would like?
Would you like us to eliminate the single residence building board of appeals fee of $220?
Which is what, I think that's what Alex was just suggesting, which we're okay because it's such an isolated occurrence that takes place. And pilot, that's right, you said for a pilot program, I'm sorry. And then reducing.
Monitor it over a year.
And then we'll report back to council next year and see where that's at.
I think I was the one that voted no on that one.
Yes, you were.
For the reason, one, it was an isolated incident. We're making a whole policy on one issue. And secondly, I don't think it should be, I don't want to create an incentive for people to follow the old, it's better to ask forgiveness and ask permission type of thing. So, and $220 is not a lot of money to ask to help offset the cost of having that. If someone goes to court, here's fees to pay for that as well. But whatever what's the pleasure of the
question,
council? Ma'am?
Christine, just give an example of when you would end up at the Building Board of Appeals.
Okay, actually, Steve Heather would be the one that manages that program. But basically, if someone challenged Steve's decision in the case that Alex was talking about, really the only thing they could challenge would be his assessment of the fee.
Okay, go back one step.
Okay.
Somebody pulls a permit to put an addition on to their house, and they do it legally, but they don't agree with his whatever he does. Ruling.
His interpretation of the code?
So it may be, he may be saying that it doesn't meet the code because of a certain material that's being used.
So this is not somebody that illegally is building. This is a resident who has pulled a permit to actually do something that now doesn't agree with your interpretation of whatever. So this is not illegal building. This is a disagreement
It's interpretation.
Of an interpretation.
Well, actually, Councilmember Higgins, it could
involve the investigation fee also. Any interpretation I make, right, is challengeable to the Building Board of Appeals. And that would include, in this particular case, whether I assess the appropriate level of investigation fee. So it can occur either for a technical item or for, in this case, that type of fee.
Okay. So, see, this, I think, is different, and that's how I agree with Councilmember Finter, that this isn't someone who is illegally building a building. This is someone who's pulled a permit but and started building or whatever. Now they have a disagreement, so they want to go to the Building Board of Appeals. So is that correct?
Yes.
So I would agree that that fee should – I'll go along with Councilmember Fincher on that.
Well, and to clarify, that the particular incident that sparked this was because of illegal building.
Yes.
But in general, in the check and balance of the system, we have a fine building official in Steve Heather. But if a citizen feels like they would like some check and balance and just go to a peer citizen group, I'm just saying we shouldn't have a financial hurdle that they feel like they have to overcome, because these the single family, the single residence folks, $220 is a lot of money to them. If this is a corporation or a contractor, I mean, they're used to doing business a little different and they have funds for doing that. So it was just to kind of generally take out any perceived hurdle that might be a problem for the small guy, the little gal. So
it could be either.
It could be either.
But be legal or illegal, illegal or construction.
Right. Okay. And honestly, I think Steve has very few requests for his interpretation on single-family residences. It's typically more a commercial, industrial kind of a development where those issues come up.
Councilwoman Higgins has another
quick question. But the illegal build is going to have a fee for their illegal build. Correct. This would be in addition to that.
Right. If they wanted to appeal the illegal construction investigation fee, which is in Alex's care, the case that we were talking about, that was the issue. They wanted to appeal Steve's decision on what the penalty assessment was, and the place to go was Building Board of Appeals. And the direction is?
It's just direction at this point?
Yeah. Well, because we're just moving forward.
I agree with Alex.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we'll just bring this forward in the fees and charges you'll see as part of the budget. Okay?
Great. Thank you. And then the last one there, are you okay with reducing the appeal of development standards for single residents to make that lower than it is for commercial or industrial?
I see general concurrence with that.
So yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Oh, I was looking at the head shaking. Sorry.
Okay. The head shaking's happening.
They could all be falling asleep.
Okay. Hey, no, I wanted to talk about the exciting customer service enhancements that we've implemented. One of the things that we have really worked on because of the staff reductions that we talked about is making a tremendous use of volunteers. We have an awful lot of students that come over to us from Arizona State University and also MCC that we love to put to work, and they do a great job for us. We also have some professional level folks that have come in and volunteer their services. So just wanted to highlight a few of those programs. John has an individual working with him on historic preservation, doing work out in the neighborhoods. We also have a student that's been working with John and Jeff McVeigh on the Central Main Street plan, doing a tremendous amount of outreach. We actually had a poster program with Mesa Public Schools to sort of have the kids envision or vision what Main Street might look like in the future, so that was real successful. In the plan review area, Steve Heather actually has an individual that came in, highly qualified, and is updating all of our guidance documents, primarily for the single family, easier kinds of things. What do you have to do to get a permit to install an addition? What do you need to do to get a swimming pool permit? Those guidance documents were relatively old and out of date, and that gentleman has done a great job for us, again, on a voluntary basis. We continue to use temporary service workers to a tremendous amount to deal with fluctuating workloads. We manage that almost on a day-to-day basis. If we have a large property or a large project coming in, Steve has the ability to bring in temporary plans examiners. John has the ability to bring in planners to help out on the entitlement side, and then we have brought in temp agency workers to help us with building inspections. So that's been very effective. We can bring those people in, pay them when we need them, but it's not additional FTE. So we will continue to manage fluctuating workloads in that manner. One of the other big projects that we've been very pleased with, we have been trying to get all of our documents into an electronic format, all of the old planning files and the old building permits, again, as a customer service enhancement so that our customers can see that information online. We currently have restarted our scanning project to make that happen, primarily with temporary workers. So we're real excited about that happening. And in the an environmental area, Scott has had a tremendous number of interns working through his group and helping out with a variety of programs. In the planning division, just real quickly, some of the innovations, extensive public outreach for the new zoning code. That's going to be coming for you before you very quickly, and Gordon Sheffield has done a tremendous amount of work with our stakeholders. We've created design guidelines for the Desert Uplands area. That was the first design guideline that had been developed as a result of the change in the design review process. Additional innovations in planning, we are regularly providing customized review schedules to assist economic development. A couple of examples there, P&H Mining, Crescent Crown, Able Engineering, and DMB First Solar that are coming through, where John's staff has really stepped up and provided creative ways to streamlining the entitlement process.
Just a second, Christina. Mayor and Council, I just want to make a point here. This group, Development Sustainability, has really become an important part of our economic development efforts. And the testimony to that is both at the groundbreakings for P&H Mining and those, if you recall, at Crescent Crown, specifically cited that the work with Development Sustainability was a significant factor in them choosing to stay in or come to Mesa, or in case of P&H Mining, stay in Mesa and expand. And so I just want to congratulate Christine and her group, because they are very much part of economic development these days, and they have been cited specifically by the CEOs of each one of those groups as their reasons for one of the reasons that they chose to come to Mesa and make either expand or make it their new headquarters. So thanks a lot for what they do.
One of the other really exciting innovations that's coming forward this weekend is the planning module of our permitting system will go online. So now our planning folks will be able to use the Tidemark system the way our plans examiners have been. And that will also allow our customers to get online, see the status of their case. So we're very excited about that. That's been a collaborative effort between our department and ITD over pretty close to the last year. Future issues in planning that are coming up, obviously implementation and training on the zoning code, training both for in-house staff and also our stakeholder community, completion of the Central Main Street plan and begin implementation of that, along with that completion of the form-based code and implementation, and also the ever-popular sign code. We anticipate that we will actually be able to start updating that this next year. That was pulled out of the zoning code, so that'll be the second piece.
That's going to be a lot of fun, though.
Yes.
That'll be a lot of fun.
We have a new element that we hadn't anticipated, and that's our historic signs.
Digital signs, all kinds of signs.
Yeah, we lost another one.
Minor
historic sign,
right.
But it was still a minor. It was
Lost
Dutchman.
So we're looking forward to lots of discussions and quality interaction during 11-12 on signs. Development and planning innovations, again, as Chris mentioned, we work very, very closely with economic development. We meet with potential new industries early on in the process, identify fatal flaws in infrastructure, what do they need for sewer lines, what do they need for water lines, really try to help them understand what the cost of development is going to be, and then identify ways that from a time perspective we can streamline it. Obviously, time is money. That's usually what we hear, and we've really, I think, been very successful in that area. We've created creative approaches to dealing with those development challenges, working with engineering, transportation, water, and gas and energy resources to really try to figure out how we can pull all of that together, have sort of one central point of contact with the development community. One of the other things that we have been working on is integration of our development agreement database with the mapping system. So what will happen if someone can go on to the city's interactive maps, click on a parcel, they'll be able to see if a development agreement is in place for that parcel, and they'll actually be able to pull it up and determine what the development agreement requirements are. We think, again, that'll be a huge assistance to anybody in the future looking at purchasing a parcel that has already agreements on it. Additional innovations, we continue to really focus on our permit by inspection activity. That's something that primarily our industrial customers really like. We can get in, we can help them get relatively minor modifications made in a very quick time. All of our plan review times, our turnaround times, have been met over the last year. And again, some of the projects that we've worked with on economic development on the development services side and have been responding to those needs by temporary services, bringing people in. So if we've got a quick turnaround time for a large project, we can bring somebody in and get it turned around very quickly. Code compliance, we're also, next one there. A couple of quick programs there that we have brought forward. The Extraordinary Properties Program that we presented to Council a while back. We'll actually have our first awards coming here shortly for the first quarter. We've updated the nuisance code. Council adopted that a couple of months ago, so that's implemented. And we're continuing to coordinate between code inspectors and building inspectors to try to maximize the ability that we have to deal with code problems beyond just the seven officers that we have. One of the major enhancements from a technology perspective that we're anticipating implementing next year is electronic plan review. We've been looking at this for the last couple of years. There's a number of cities across the country that have e-plan review. That's basically plans are submitted electronically. We get rid of the massive rolls of paper. Plans examiners can be looking at plans, talking to the engineer, the architect, who can be, you know, back east someplace, looking at that online, making those corrections. Some of the reports we've had from other cities that can increase the efficiency of our plans examiners, something in the range of 25 to 50%. So we're very excited about that. That will actually be funded from the environmental fee. That fee is a 4% assessment on each permit, and it's absolutely dead.
Technology.
What did I say?
Environmental.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's our it's the technology fee, and that's dedicated. It can only be used for technology enhancements, so we've got an RFP going right now, and we anticipate that we'll be able to fund implementation in fiscal year 11-12. I'm going to turn it over to Scott to talk about environmental and sustainability.
Okay. A couple innovations with environmental and sustainability. We received a Valley Forward Award for our Living Green Workshop Series, which is a series that's our public outreach that Christine was talking about earlier, that we work with the libraries on doing monthly workshops on sustainability and how you can be more sustainable at home. We've successfully implemented a prescription medication program, disposal program at our household hazardous waste events, and to date we've collected over 500 gallons of medications, and that's actually loose pills. That's 500 gallons of loose pills, if you can imagine the amount of pills that go into 500 gallons. It's been a very, very successful program that we've had there. The energy efficiency grant that Christine was discussing, we've actually been audited three separate times, both from internal and external auditors, and the Department of Energy have come down, and we've been successful in all three of those audits so far. And one of the things, we've received our first rebate from SRP for our energy efficiency projects. It's one of the things that we focused on when we started looking at energy efficiencies, is the ability to get funds from SRP for some of the projects that we do. So we look forward to, in the future, receiving more of those rebates from SRP and reinvesting those into additional energy efficiency projects. With that, I'm going to go to the environmental compliance fee and give Council an overview of the fee. The history of the fee was implemented in January of 2007, and it pays for unfunded environmental mandates, both state and federal. It is $3 per utility account per month and generates approximately $5.8 million per year. I'm going to go into the four departments now that actually receive funds from the environmental fee and the services, the eligible activities that are covered by the fund. In environmental and sustainability, there's $2.1 million, and the actual environmental and sustainability is fully funded from the environmental fee. The things that we cover are air quality, stormwater compliance. Many of these things I've been here before to talk to you guys about. Hazardous waste, asbestos, lead-based paint, public health are the things that we deal with in environmental. Also our, yes, Councilmember Richens.
Scott.
Dave.
Who determines what an eligible expense is on the environmental fee?
When we originally created the fee back in 2007, there was a council report that was put together that was approved by council that determined what activities would fall under activities that would be eligible with the environmental fee. And what we do, I've really been tasked with tracking what those eligible expenses are and how they're tracked through our financial system. So many times when something comes up, they'll come back to me, and I go back to that original council report that laid out what activities are covered and what aren't. Right. Most of what we have, it needs to tie back to some form of legislation. Many of the things that we do, it's either Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act.
Federal or state mandate.
I figure there is a federal tie there.
Federal or state. It's either a federal or state mandate that's unfunded, that's passed on to the cities.
Okay.
And then that's kind of the broadest way.
Right.
That's fair.
Right.
That we would, then we categorize those as being eligible under this program. And that's where it all started, because we had so many projects, whether it's stormwater or street sweeping, that were coming down from the federal government that we just didn't have the other funding for, and so that's how we funded that from this fee.
So just to be clear, just want to make sure I understand right. So things that the federal government has determined is good for the good for the environment, whether through the EPA or another piece of legislation, and told cities they have to do it, allocated no funding to us to do it.
Correct.
And so we implemented this fee to try to help defray the costs to the city for implementing those things.
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Councilwoman Higgins.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. I'm going back two slides. The $3 per utility account.
Yes.
Have we ever that we came up with that number? We can collect this anywhere we want. Have we ever thought of like we do water, three-tiered approach to electricity, so it's not more burdensome on the lower bill and fairer for the higher bill?
We did when we originally put together the fee. We were looking at doing maybe it started off looking at stormwater, and we were looking at impervious areas, what some cities have done in regards to looking at how much impervious area do you have and what is the impact on our system when you do that. In looking at that, one of the examples that I give is you have some large industrial facilities that are actually zero discharge. So they have a lot of impervious area, but because of the environmental regulations that do exist, they retain all of their stormwater on site, for example. So their impact is actually lower than what you would have even from a single-family residence and the fact that the storm sewer system, because they're not releasing stormwater into our system at all. One of the other things that I've discussed before is, like, with air quality, it's hard to determine what impact everybody is going to have on impact or on air quality, and then what they're going to use in regards to air quality, because air doesn't know any of the borders that are existing, that we've put in place, whether they're from cities or property lines or whatever it may be. So one of the things that we did when we set up the per utility account per month was to try and set up a simple way, knowing that all the residents in Mesa and the businesses in Mesa are receiving a benefit from this from the environmental standpoint.
But
except we're billing the single retiree the same as the family of six or the business of 400. I never think that's fair. So, this is not the first time we have a fee that's like that. And I just think, yes, one person versus 400, there is a difference. Even if you're zero discharge, and we're not just talking wastewater, we're talking a whole list of things you've come up with. Right. Not you, but we have come up with.
And
so anyway, that could be something we look at.
If the council would like us at some point in the future, we could look at a more tiered approach. We're not opposed to that. Obviously, this is the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
Well, the idea would still be to collect the same amount of dollars. It's just how you allocate that out within the distribute that within your customers. So we're certainly, if that's the direction council wants to give us, we can look at that.
Thank you.
Get back to our fleet department also received some funds from the environmental fee. They received $95,000 for storage tank compliance. This is inspections of our fueling storage tanks. There's some daily inspections that need to be done. There's testing that need to be done to those tanks to ensure that they're in compliance with environmental regulations. In addition to that, our parks and recreation retention basin maintenance is an eligible activity. There's $4.9 million in eligible expenses. I'll get into the details of that 4.9 on the next slide. What this includes is landscaping, watering, fertilization, replacement of trees and shrubs, tree trimming, inspections. The way that retention basins are pulled into the environmental fee is that retention basins play a major role, a key role in our storm sewer system. They are considered one of our best management practices for stormwater pollution prevention. They capture the water and the pollutants before they're released out of our storm sewer system and out into waters in the United States. So this is one of the major best management practices that we have for our stormwater program that we report to the DEQ. So just to cover it, there's $4.9 million that Parks has identified in eligible expenses that they have. The current environmental fee funding that they have is $3.6 million, which actually leaves an unfunded need of $1.3 million for the Parks and Recreation Department.
Just to be clear, why it says unfunded, it's unfunded from this fee, but obviously then it's covered up by the general fund. So the general fund essentially, this is the general fund's burden of the mandate that
so
it's having
funded,
to pay.
Funded, unfunded need?
Well, it's...
That's correct. I had to think that one through a bit. Yes, that's correct. A general fund unfunded.
All right. Moving on.
Okay. So here are the basins that exist in the city of Mesa currently, just to give you an idea of the number of basins that we're dealing with. Many of these, you know, I don't know that everybody realizes that they are a basin that takes care of stormwater issues. A lot of times they look like parks. But they are retention basins that are holding stormwater and helping us. With transportation plays a key role both in air quality and stormwater regulations for the city of Mesa. With street sweeping, it's actually a best management practice for stormwater and also considered a control measure. There are two different terms that are used for our air quality program. They're sweeping debris off of the streets, keeps it out of our storm drain systems, prevents it from even getting to those retention basins that we mentioned earlier. Also, the dirt that they're removing from the streets prevents cars from going over that and then creating an air quality problem. So it's an air quality measure also for PM10, which is an issue for the valley. With our storm drain maintenance, again, if it hasn't been swept up before off the street by our street sweepers, our transportation crews out there cleaning our storm sewer system, again, trying to prevent it from going into our retention basins, and this also serves as a flood control practice for us. So currently, between street sweeping, which is $2.2 million, and storm drain maintenance, which is $1 million, there's $3.2 million in eligible expenses from the transportation department, and currently none of that is funded with the environmental fee. In closing, the environmental fee is currently $3 per utility account per year. Generates $5.8 million, and we're at approximately 57% cost recovery when you break down all those eligible expenses that I mentioned earlier. And a 25-cent increase of a fee generates $481,998, approximately $500,000 if you want to do easy math.
Okay.
Councilmember Cavanaugh.
And so that raises the question, are you recommending any change in that environmental fee for budget purposes for this year?
We're actually just putting it out there, and if you'd like to provide direction on whether or not...
Council, we've been able, the budget summary you'll see later today doesn't anticipate the need for that increase. Obviously, what's currently being funded out of the general fund today, there's about a $300,000. And then the balance of that is being funded, the $3.2 million is being funded out of the streets fund. We wanted to present it to council, at least not know what the options are, whether we do it this year or in the next year. Obviously, if we picked up 25 cents would help us fund the balance of what is currently being funded in the general fund in the parks, the parks maintenance program. Obviously, that helps. That could go towards other things, priorities of the council in the budget if you chose to do that. Anything above that would then obviously could be offset and go to the streets fund. Now, what that does essentially allows us to pave more streets. It's not a general fund benefit, but it allows, dollars that are being spent for street sweeping and stormwater maintenance otherwise be used for overlays and street maintenance programs. We really want to make it for informational purposes because we've kind of had the discussion with the budget. We've been able to come up with a balanced budget without having to increase this, but that's just not – we really haven't gotten into maybe there are other council priorities that you think are necessary that may require additional funding, and so that would be an option, I guess.
Mr. Finter, our subcommittee discussed this particular issue in a little bit more detail than it's provided here. I think this is something ripe for full council discussion. Separate?
Absolutely. And the feedback that, or the feelings that I got is, and without oversimplifying it or getting on a soapbox or anything, is ADEQ, we provide a plan to ADEQ, and they approve that. That is the state regulation over our cities. And the state legislature, you know, removes some funding and puts some pressures on us. And so that cost moved down as to the city. And so in looking at this, I've had some concerns, but I think it's a fair question to ask that for cost recovery for some of the regulations that are put on the city, should we pass it on to the citizens or try to absorb it in the current system? And I think, personally, my feeling is that it needs to be passed on to the citizens, and we need to line item it in bold heading that this is why we're doing this. It's not meant to spite or get into any political debate. It is what it is. But if you're going to reduce the funding, why don't you reduce the regulation? Obviously, that didn't happen, so we have the regulation to deal with as a local government. And so I think there's a fair question, or at least a fair argument to make, that we need to pass on these additional costs or try and get our system, in that, capture it in the environmental fee.
Yeah, and I would like to see more of a percentage-based or some type of sliding scale so that we're not treating everybody the same with this, because then it becomes a regressive tax?
Yes.
So I'd rather see it tied to any bill you want to tie it to, your water usage bill. You know, I'm a third-tier water usage customer. I'm willing to pay the extra amount of money because I am using the water. So that type of thing.
For the rest of the council, without committing to any support, is there enough support to at least discuss this issue at a study session? Yes? Dave, okay. Yeah, all right. So, yes, sir.
So what would it be to fully cost recover for the general fund again with regard to the...
There's two things that you see in the... what's left for the general fund with the general fund is the under the Parks and Recreation, because the stormwater and the street sweeping now are being funded out of the street maintenance fund, specific sales tax for streets. So while that benefits streets, it doesn't necessarily benefit the general fund. The number we've shown you includes about $300,000 in current expenses that are being covered by the general fund today that otherwise are eligible because they're related to the stormwater management in the parks. The million is, frankly, the maintenance and the watering and the fertilization that we've cut out of the budget over the last 5 years in parks. And frankly, it's showing. And so what we would suggest is, for a savings benefit, let me split them up, for a savings benefit, there's at least $300,000 that we've identified today in the Parks Department. So that 25 cents or something close to that, or maybe a little less than that, would more than cover the balance of what we're spending in the general fund specifically. In the past, we have spent more on the care of our parks, watering, fertilization, trees. At some point, we think we need to get back there because we're kind of losing some of the turf in some of our parks because we're not doing that. But that's dollars we've already cut out of the budget, so anything that we would add above that towards that million would not necessarily save us money, but it would allow us to begin restoring back some of the turf in those same drainage basins that are now used for parks.
As a follow-up, those parks/retention basins are a key component of our DEQ water permit process for capturing.
Absolutely.
So people don't confuse it saying, hey, we're trying to improve the parks and on this fee. That is a vital part of that overall permit plan to capture that wastewater. And then as we mow and clean up, we take away those pollutants. So it's just so they understand, that's part of this environmental portion of that.
They're strategically placed mm-hmm. to capture the runoff before it gets into the main drains that take it to the waterways or whatever. Is that
right,
fair?
Right, that ultimately go to the Salt and Gila River. Those right. are the ultimate
So we hold it and treat the pollutants there.
If I could just clarify, it's stormwater, not wastewater.
Excuse me. Oh, yeah. yeah. We're not in that business. That's another.
Anything, Dave?
I think Alex makes an excellent point in clarifying that, but also you get additional bang for your buck because you get open space and park space in your neighborhood as a result, which is really cool. So it's like
it's a good
kind
program.
Of a double efficiency or double benefit to the citizen,
Absolutely.
Which I think is great.
Okay, why don't we bring that back with the eye toward what the options are, give a little history of the unfunded mandates and recent changes,
well, maybe
and
get
also,
some okay.
and then address the equity issue heard. That okay. Councilwoman Higgins is concerned about. So
we can do that.
Very right. good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's put this one to bed. Not that it hasn't been thoroughly enjoyable, thanks. And we're going to go to the next item, which is here a presentation discussion the status of the, oh great, Employee Benefits Trust Fund. At least you kept it to 12 slides. Thank you. Are there pictures?
Are there pictures?
Hey, there's benefits. A graph.
Good morning, Vice Mayor Summers and members of council. I'm Gary Manning with Human Resources. With me today is Margie Ward. She is our new benefits administrator. Margie comes to us from the city of St. Petersburg, Florida, and we're really excited about having Margie on board with us and the expertise that she brings to that position. This morning, we wanted to take a few minutes and share with you an update on the Benefit Trust Fund. As you'll recall, last year, right about this time, I gave a presentation to you that talked about the health of the trust fund, and in particular, some of the concerns that we had with the rising cost of medical expenses. As a result of those concerns, we implemented a new contribution philosophy in January of this year, and this morning we just wanted to give you a brief update on some of the trends, some of the early trends that we're seeing as a result of that, as well as what's being budgeted for 11-12. Just by way of a reminder, we have four main types of benefit insurance plans. Those are funded through a variety of funding sources, including contributions from the city, employee premiums, as well as some subsidies that comes back to us from the state retirement system as a result of employees who retire but remain on our benefit plans. And like last year, I'm happy to report to you that dental, vision, and life insurance plans continue to be self-sustaining. During the presentation last year, we reported medical expense increases were significantly outpacing our contributions. I'm happy to report to you that we're cautiously optimistic that as a result of some of the claims management initiatives that we put into place, we are anticipating that some of those expenses are leveling off just a little bit. We're anticipating some reduction in those expenses. However, we want to be clear that there are a couple of still outstanding issues that we need to be careful about. First of all, we really don't know the impact yet of the number of new dependents that were added to the plans as a result of health care reform. We had about 424 new dependents ages 19 through 26 that were added to the plan, and we've really only had about 3 months of actual data, January, February, and March. So we don't know the full impact of what those new dependents will be to it, but I'm happy to report to you, at least cautiously optimistic, that some of those expenses seem to be headed in the right direction. The other thing, Margie and the benefits team have really done a great job in claims audit negotiations as well as provider plan compliance audits. And as a result of those efforts, we've already seen in just January, February, and March, about $300,000 in savings with negotiations, and almost about $426,000 just as a result of those compliance audits. So Margie and the team are doing a great job with that. This next slide, as a result of these efforts, shows how some of these medical expenses are coming down. This is the same slide that I showed you last year. Up on top with the active employees, the dotted line shows what we estimated those expenses were going to be. The solid blue line shows what our revised estimate expenses are going to be. So there has been actually some reduction in those costs, and we're excited about that. Effective in January of this year, a new contribution model was put into play, as you'll recall. Our goal over the next 3 years is to have a self-sustaining cost recovery model. And at the basis of that model, the employee and retiree contributions really are calculated based on what the expenses of the base plan, that 80-20 plan, about 20% of those expenses is how employee contributions then are determined as well. We did anticipate that this was going to be a three-year phase-in approach. It's going to take us some time before we actually get to that cost recovery model, but we're headed in the right direction, and as a result of that, both employee and city contributions did increase in January of this year, but as you'll recall, employee contributions really had not changed since about 2008. The proposed city contributions for fiscal year 11-12 is about $54.8 million. That would include all of our health programs. Medical contributions account for about $46.5 million, and that's divided between active and retired employees. And a reminder that the city contribution is budgeted on a fiscal year basis, while the plans really are managed on more of a calendar year basis. The next slide really shows just an overview of both expenses, revenues, as well as the fund balance. If you look at 08-09, the green bar shows the fund balance, and that's really where we had some concerns. If you look at 08-09, 09-10, and at least at that time budgeted for 10-11, you saw that the fund balance was dropping pretty significantly. As a result, we put in that new contribution model, and if you take a look at the 10-11 and 11-12 estimates, again, we're cautiously optimistic that revenue and expenses are going to be somewhat equal with one another. Potential plan year 2012 cost savings measures. There are at least three things that we're anticipating doing for the future that is going to save us even more money. We're looking seriously at applying an allowable cost model for our out-of-network providers. As you know, our out-of-network providers really have no obligation to reduce their costs like the in-network providers as a result of being participants on the Blue Cross Blue Shield contract. But there is an industry standard out there that would help us identify what we believe the reasonable costs would be for those kinds of services, even for out-of-network providers, and we're going to begin implementing that model. We're thinking about replacing the out-of-area network. Currently, that's HealthSmart. We don't feel like we're getting quite the bang for our buck that we should be with HealthSmart, and so we're probably over the next few weeks going to be putting out an RFP to try to replace that out-of-state network, and we think we're going to be saving some money and provide a whole lot better customer service than what we have now. We're also going to take a hard look at whether or not it continues to make sense if we provide our retirees some kind of Medicare discount. Wanted to share with you some additional revenue that we have already received and ongoing. As a result of simply making application and doing our due diligence, we received about $402,000 in terms of reimbursement for retiree drug coverage. And as a result of Margie's efforts in working with our stop-loss carrier matrix, working with a good audit plan, we've already received about $947,000 already in those stop-loss reimbursements.
Yeah, Councilwoman Higgins has a question.
Can you explain what stop-loss claims reimbursement is?
Sure. We contract with Matrix, which is our stop-loss carrier. What that means is, in case we have catastrophic expenses as a result of some very high dollar claims, there is a threshold in our contract that says the first $175,000 we have to pay ourselves. But if a claim exceeds $175,000, that's where stop loss comes into play, and they actually reimburse us for those funds. The stop loss carrier, though, they're somewhat reluctant about insuring an organization that doesn't have a good audit plan in place, an organization that doesn't have good claims management systems in place. And Margie and her team have done a great job working with Matrix, revising those claims management protections, and they're a lot more comfortable now with what they're providing us.
So Matrix is a third-party insurance that we insure with for these things?
They're a reinsurer.
Okay.
Yeah,
you know, this is that big black box of insurance. It's very confusing. Okay, great. Thanks.
Yes. The next steps for us, we'd like to return back to you in late fall, probably in September. By that time, we'll have had quite a number of months of actual claims payments, so we'll know what those expenses are. We'll have a little better understanding of healthcare reform, including what those additional dependents are going to be on the plan. and we'll be reviewing with you at that time some additional plan design changes that we would be anticipating for January of 2012. So with that, that's kind of an update of where we are today from last year.
Council member Fenter.
Thank you. With regard to the looking at the Medicaid challenges, you said you're going to look at that.
Yes.
If you involve RECOM, make sure that you know they have some input on that. That I think that's really important.
RECOM is the retired
Mesa City employee group that, and they've been very active. And I know there's great representation there, and that's important part. Last, you know, for me, I'd say walk carefully. The last thing we want to do is all those grandmas out there that are widows or, you know, whatever, impact them negatively. Is they're already in a tough spot with this economy. The only other thing, and I've mentioned this to at least one of the committee members that works with the employee benefits part, being a tightwad that I am, I'm always looking in this menu of options that we have in programs and plans. For that bottom line program that you tell me where to go to get a procedure, you've negotiated with them and somehow I get a benefit on the deductible or it's less expensive for me to do, almost like that medical doctor to the mining camp. It was the only medical doctor. You just go there and get what's done. And I know folks that have loved their dentists and loved their doctors and they're going to never leave those, and there's probably a premium to pay there. Folks like me, I don't care who sticks me or probes me or whatever. Just tell me the cheapest way to do it, and I'll get through it. So someday I'd love to see.
I'm sorry.
No, I went way too far. But
someday, mental image.
I know, sorry. But someday it would be nice to see on that menu for the cheapskates of the world that says, hey, just tell me where to go and get me the cheapest way to do it, because this isn't a big deal in my life. So anyway, thanks.
Yes, you bet. We'll do that.
As long as it's not a primary care paramedic. Dave?
I just wanted to get a sense of utilization between existing employees and retirees. What are our utilizations like?
Typically, the retiree group has higher utilization, some additional medical concerns that they would have over active employees. We could come back to you probably with some numbers about what the specific utilization difference is between retirees and actives, but in general, utilization is usually quite a bit higher with our retiree population.
Just as a percentage or in total overall cost?
Both.
Because I'm guessing we have less do we have less retirees than active employees?
Yes.
But our retiree group, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the answer to is it a percentage of utilization more or total actual cost utilization?
The actual total costs are more for active employees because we have over twice as many active employees as we have retirees. But what we can bring back to you, if you would find it helpful, is the average cost per retiree versus the average cost per active employee, and then also run a percentage of the retiree cost against the employee cost versus the percentage of retirees against employees.
No, that would be good. And also, we need to look at that over time as well, because going forward, you know, what's the anticipated retirements in this fiscal year, in the next fiscal year, maybe model it out. I don't know, Chuck, can we model it out for 10 or 15 years, and we start getting an idea then at that point?
We already have these.
Well, I would give you some assurances. We've already taken our retiree models and included it in this plan of balancing for the next 3 years, so those factors are already in there.
Can we just see that?
Sure. Yes, and one other thing that I would just point out on the cost issue is the Medicare, because we've become secondary on the Medicare issue, changes that ratio on your retiree cost versus active cost. So that's why some of the they're not straight answers today. We'll have to do some research.
Yeah. What I would bring back to you is the pre-Medicare retirees versus post-Medicare retirees, because there's a very large difference in that.
The retiree benefit, post-retirement benefits have also changed here in the last few years. So some employees are.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's really not covered, or
well, what's that? Yeah, but that will be 20 years from now before we'll start seeing that.
Right, but we've made some changes.
But we've made the changes because one of the things that we have to report now is an actuarial study of what these costs will be over a 30-year period.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's fairly significant even after we made the changes. But we have made some significant changes in this program, but it will take some time before we start seeing the real benefit here. But it was the right thing to do then. Here we're just trying to manage the cost, and I think one of the things you're going to see is Mesa does provide some unique discounts to our retirees that is not comparable anywhere else, and we want to be careful, obviously, not to impact them dramatically, but we do think that there's trying to be fair and reasonable to everybody, and I think we can bring that back in the fall.
Absolutely.
When we have more information.
Have we set up any accounts? I know that other communities, other businesses set up healthcare account, retiree accounts that contributed into kind of like a 401k for medical purposes, that as long as you're employed, everybody gets to share.
We've been looking at those as options for our new employees now that are not part of this plan going forward, to at least give them some opportunities that they can, the city can contribute into, and they can contribute into
while they're
going
employed.
Forward. That's correct.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
But we benchmark all our costs against other cities or other municipalities. We're not, our employees aren't like overspending compared to anybody else.
Councilmember Higgins, we do look at the other cities throughout the valley, trying to take a look at their benefits package. Sometimes it's a complicated analysis because everyone offers different levels, their deductibles are different, their contracts may be different, but we do make a sizable effort to at least compare as best we can apples to apples to what our premiums are versus others and the level of service that we can provide.
And I know we have prescription drug plan, but have we or anyone ever done the analysis of what it, because I do, because that's me, I'm a numbers person, but paying cash at like a retail pharmacy like Costco, you actually are cheaper than sometimes paying the copay that we would pay.
Yeah,
so I mean, that information would be great for employees that say, hey, you know, and just by the way, you don't have to be a member to use the Costco pharmacy. You can just go in and use the Costco pharmacy. Sure. I don't know if you guys knew that. But. And then I'm sure they're hoping as you walk through the store, you'll want to be a member. But anyway, yeah, I mean, if people knew that, you know, you could. It's less to pay your own cash. You don't even use your insurance. I mean, that's good for me. That's good for the insurance company, and that's good for everybody.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
So, anyway, we could talk about that.
It's good.
You bet.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Done?
They'll be back in the fall.
Back in September.
Thank you.
But we are going to move on right now.
Yes, we're moving on.
We're going to move on to the next item, which is the hear a presentation, discuss the fiscal year 11-12 capital improvement program overview. You want a five-minute break? Five-minute break.
Say three.
I'm just ready to go. All right, let's take a five-minute break.
Okay.
We're going to resume our discussion with the fiscal year 11-12 capital improvement program overview.
Yes.
All yours.
Good morning. This morning, what we'd like to do is just give you an overview of the capital improvement program that's included in the fiscal year 11-12 budget that's coming forward to you. And with me today is Anthony Araza, who is our CIP, which is Capital Improvement Program Administrator.
I'll go ahead and kick it off.
I'm going to let him take it off. Take it away.
Now, I know I've done this before in the past. So this is the first time for this current council. I've done it when Councilmember Kavanaugh was on the previous councils, and Vice Mayor, I've done it for you when you first started. So this is a good brush up on just the overall CIP process and what the end product is that you'll be adopting here in about a month or two. Basically, the process involves all RCs and employs a hybrid philosophy of financial and technical aspects of a project on equal footing. So as it moves through the project phases, such as a design phase, construction phase, right-of-way acquisition, project closeout, operations and maintenance, we do the entire look of the project life cycle costs, I would call it, including O&M costs. And those are all fleshed out with the exercise that we do each year. The first bullet is a multi-year capital infrastructure needs. This is our five-year snapshot, five-year CIP book that you'll be adopting in June. Next bullet, council appropriates the first year of the plan. This obviously is the most important year of the five-year program. This is the part of the overall budget adoption that becomes the commitment of the city to develop, design, and construct capital improvement projects. This also includes the purchases of large equipment, such as fire equipment and other large equipment that are what we consider capital costs. Third bullet, Council adopts the year 2 through 5. This is what I call program amounts, program years of the project. And as you know, projects occur over multiple years to finish. This indicates the plan of how projects are cash flowed till completion of the project. What we do, too, is the joint planning, and this starts September 1st of every year with all the departments and ends around the May timeframe, June timeframe. During this time, joint planning opportunities are fleshed out, combining the infrastructure needs under one project, and this helps mitigate disruption to the public, obviously, and achieve economies of scale for that project, such as wastewater, water lines, electric, gas, under one street project. So we get them all done once for all and get out of that arterial street. The next bullet is schedules are coordinated with the funding and priorities are aligned. As you know, in the bond elections, we have various bond programs of different infrastructure. So if these infrastructure needs are going to be combined in one project, we also have to align the funding of the appropriate infrastructure too as well. And that's what we do with this yearly process with all the departments and accounting and the budget office. Project costs are reviewed and updated. This is by the engineering department, which I currently am. That's where the CIP office is now, in engineering. This is equally important, too, because it reflects current bidding climate and commodity costs and other timely information needed to more accurately depict project capital costs. Next bullet, accurate timeline of project phases, which equals the target date of project completion. This is achieved by doing accurate cash flowing of each of the projects over the multiple fiscal years. For example, does right-of-way need to be included in this project, which would allocate some time for the project, which would push construction of the project. So we kind of accurately depict that and what all phases of the project need to be depicted in the five-year CIP. The next one is one that at least I've been doing this for 11 years. We've been doing it for the last 4 years, and now we require the departments to do an 8-year CIP forecast. And this helps by keeping the information of the projects fresh and timely. And accurately reflects any change in conditions, such as updates to the master plans, management or council priority changes. And we use all the other documents too as well, such as in the transportation program. I can think of one, Dan Clevenger's program, where we use MAG's RTP update, which is regional transportation program. That's the 70-30 funding split that MAG gives us for the money. And so they change their cash flows every year, so it's only appropriate to accurately depict those costs in our street program. We also assess staffing capacity to deliver the projects. That is on the design side, construction side, and inspection side as well. And then finally, the CIP plan is consistent with the current utility rate models and the proposed tax levy. The snapshot for the 11-12 preliminary CIP, as you see, Parks and Recs is first, and that's, of course, the spring training facility. Public safety, which is a modest $5 million, and that's the Fiesta District Police Station. Transportation at $65 million, and utilities at $93 million. Now, obviously, utilities every year for the past, since I've been doing it, utilities has over half of the capital improvement projects. And most of these next year will be replacement of aging infrastructure. Some of the project highlights for next year is, of course, the spring training facility for the Chicago Cubs, the Fiesta District Police Substation, Central Mesa Corridor Light Rail Extension, which is fully reimbursable by Metro Light Rail, ASU Poly, the street and utility improvements. We have some aging infrastructure that we've inherited. 60-year-old utility lines that we need to replace, and also do some street improvements too. And of course, the infrastructure improvements in support of the economic development activities such as First Solar. Some of the projects that you may be aware of that are not included in the CIP is, of course, the HPANs. That's the Highway Project Advancement Notes. That's the financial instrument that ADOT supplies to local government for acceleration of any freeways. And, of course, we're accelerating the State Route 24 of the right-of-way acquisition and design phases for that project, so it can be accelerated. And, again, that's, of course, in the Southeast Mesa area, in the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. And, of course, the ABLE project, too, as well. I'll turn it over to Candace to go over the CIP funding pie.
What we'll be showing you here is just for the 11-12 fiscal year of the capital improvement program. These are where our funding sources are coming from. So as you can see, as Anthony discussed, most of our projects are utility projects. So the bulk of our funding comes from utility revenue bonds. Almost 53% of it is from utility revenue bonds. So you can see where the breakout is there. The bulk of this is bonds. If you notice the green pie, that is our federal, state, and regional funding. So those are our grants or reimbursements. And you see our other funding sources really, really small because those are the cash projects. So at this point, our funding comes from alternate sources other than cash for our CIP. As Anthony mentioned earlier, our capital improvement program is designed and developed over multi-years. We take these, this is the utility revenue bond portion of that, and this is consistent with the rate models that we came to you with last week for utility rate models. This is the background to that on the projects that are included in those utility rate models over time. At this point, this is just, there's another attachment that you have that shows you the actual projects for the 11-12 fiscal year. It's just a real small blurb about what the project is about and the total dollar costs. When you receive your capital improvement program book, that will have the full five-year look at those particular projects and the timeline. The one that we provided you today is just what is going to be included in the 11-12 fiscal year budget that's going to come forward to you.
So, Vice Mayor, Council, what's included in here is both, and you'll see that when we get to 12-13 next year, that number will actually grow, because what happens is what you're seeing even in 11-12 as projects that are underway during this current fiscal year that don't get completed, they get rolled into the next year. So a large portion, and I don't know we've come up with a number yet that we're rolling.
It's around $51 million.
So about over $50 million, that 175 are projects that were in this current year schedule. But just because, you know, the contracts won't be completed, they may be under design and then we're going to go into construction next year. We'll have to roll them over to appropriate those dollars. So it doesn't change that we're significantly increasing our debt for the city or any of those obligations. It's just we have to reflect the year in which the projects will be worked on. So we're very conservative. So we'll have projects that will roll over that won't be completed or closed out this year. There's $50 million of that. Then we'll have projects that we anticipate starting going forward. Also included in this list, as we were covered by the budget office, is that we include projects that include regional dollars. So there's a significant amount of regional dollars that we get from Prop 400 that match up against some of our street projects. So that's what's also included in that $175 million. So it's not all dollars that are generated by the city. It's dollars coming in, I guess, both federal dollars as well as the regional dollars, which are fairly significant, especially when you look at the streets projects. And then you had Dan present today.
Intelligent transportation.
Yeah. Transportation dollars, all federal dollars right. Coming in. But we have to allocate them. We have to appropriate them in the budget so we can expend those dollars during the year. Now, just as Dan came to you today with a capital budget, just as we'll come to you with the construction of utility projects or street projects, council will see those projects during the year, but we establish the budget for it. We're very conservative, meaning we assume we're going to be able to get all these projects done next year. Inevitably, fire stations run into issues with reviews with the federal government. Capacity to put projects out with staff may become an issue. But we want to be conservative. So that's what the larger number is. But it doesn't impact. It's not $175 million more in debt, because there's a lot of other dollars coming in. But we still maintain it consistent with our discussions on the tax levy that is set to pay off our general obligation debt. It's consistent with the schedules we showed you in the utility fund, the expected debt service that we have there. We're not adding any more debt than we've already talked to you about in the past. So this is just it's a big, big number. But remember, some of it's rolling over. Some of it's dollars coming in from outside the city. But it is still consistent with our overall plan. This will be a part of the budget adoption.
Yes.
This part of the capital improvement program. In about 2 weeks, we'll give you the five-year program. It's not going to be tremendously different because these are projects that were outlined in our, whether it was our utility bond authorization or general obligation bond authorization. We're not adding projects that are unfunded, okay? So that's what you will see. What we have to do is sometimes we have to reprioritize the budget or the projects throughout the five-year program to try to balance out the needs of when we may need that project sooner or later in the schedule, and that's what you'll see in 2 weeks.
I do want to just clarify also that the $175 million is before we have actually rolled over the 10-11 projects. So that number will go up for final when you do a final capital improvement program. The book that you receive will just be the new projects that would be starting in 11-12 and beyond. Okay. Then we go through another exercise where we actually then roll that current appropriation over to the next year. So that number will go higher as the end result for the final.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Haney.
And when you say book, you mean the file, right? Because it's going to be digital. We're not actually getting a huge book because that's the worst book ever.
The publication. Capital Improvement Program publication.
We're going to have it.
Will be electronically distributed to you.
Fabulous. Because, you know, it weighs like 5 pounds.
We are now. We are now going to provide you digitally. Yeah. Absolutely.
If you don't want a physical copy, we'd be happy not to produce a physical copy for you. But
well, it could be online for all of the world.
And we've done
and
that.
We do. And we do. Yeah. And we actually put it on our website.
Please don't give me a book.
Okay.
Please don't give me a book. Dick, stick, whatever you want. You know, file, Dropbox. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, we always have that. We've always posted it onto our website. So the same day that you receive the publication is the same day that that publication will be available on the website for all to view.
We'll see if Dropbox can handle it.
Sure. That's not. Mr. Fenter, you have something?
Appreciate the presentation. I have two questions. One would be with regard to that preliminary CIP summary. That's 25 pages long of projects.
Yes, it is.
And the counsel I'd give to myself is I'm going through that page by page, and there's a few questions that have come up and that don't need to be discussed here, but I would have questions later because I know a lot of those may need some counsel direction. I know that I don't know if they're written in stone. So that my question would be, who do I talk to kind of run through, you know, that 25 pages of projects?
These two,
okay,
right?
Okay.
So we'll make those arrangements. The other one would be, it would be nice if we had a one-minute snapshot, and I don't know if it's budget or who, and I think we've gotten this at the Audit and Finance Committee, but a look at how well the city does with regard to debt. I know at a federal level it is a hypersensitive issue, and people are really concerned about their government debting themselves and what the impact is on the future. It would be nice to have someone give a quick snapshot with regard to our upgrade, you know, with Moody's and Standards and Poor's.
We just didn't meet.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Right. And then all the others, because I think people will be happily surprised to see how well.
Great, Councilman. 2 weeks ago, we had that homeowner survey. We're bringing that back. When did we just say we're going to bring that back?
Next week, we'll be bringing that one back.
So when we bring that back, we'll do also the comparison of our kind of per capita debt compared to other communities. So we can provide that. But remember, we were asked to update that homeowner survey.
Right.
So we'll do that, and we can address that issue at the same time. Okay?
Well, city doesn't borrow money for operation, continued operations. We're not in the business of, you know, providing health insurance or to citizens or anything like that, entitlement programs. We borrow money to build fire stations and streets, and we pay that back. We still have the fire station and the streets for a good period of time. We're very, very careful about how much debt we take on as a community in purchasing those items. You know, similarly, people borrow money for
cars and take out a mortgage for their house, same kind of thing. We're very careful on how much we take in, how much we borrow. So that's a point well taken, and people need to know exactly how much debt local government is taking on. Anything else on this? Anyone? Anyone? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Pressing on, I think our last major presentation will be to hear, discuss, and provide directions on the FY 11-12 budget.
Vice Mayor and Council, we just want to kind of give a summary. Today we kind of finished up the last of the presentations by the departments with development sustainability. We have a few of the departments that we weren't going to bring in front of you, but we have that summary of the impacts that Candace will go through, and then just kind of tie it all together from what we discussed earlier about our forecast and how we've now kind of put all the big picture together for you to see.
So we've heard the major ones, and then these are the rest of them that either had very little impact.
We just didn't know that it would be necessary to bring them in front of the council, each one of these, but we've done it in a summary form, so you have that for you. Go ahead.
Okay. So as City Manager mentioned, what we've done is throughout the month of April, we've had many departments that have come before you and reviewed their budget with you, any outstanding issues, and also any of the reductions that they were recommending in order to meet our previously forecasted budget shortfall. So we've gone through those. So what we're going to go through really quickly are the departments that did not actually present in front of you, because they did make some significant contributions to that shortfall gap. Business services is the first one that we're going to go over. We did achieve $330,000 in general fund savings in their department, and that was basically taking their sales tax collection administration and charging that out to the local street sales tax fund, who was previously not really paying for the administration of that. So that was allocating that out there. In the communications department, they achieved about $168,000 in general fund savings through consolidating their service contracts, and about $136,000 of that was in the general fund. So some of these departments are funded by multiple funding sources. So while they made reductions, I'm going to show you both the reduction that they made as well as the effect on the general fund. Not all of them are 100% on the general fund. In engineering, they were able to identify $134,000 worth of labor that was really supposed to be allocated out to the capital improvement program, because they actually work in support of those projects. And that was a savings to the general fund in that respect as well. In our facility maintenance area, they identified $396,000 in savings through streamlining of their contracts. They went out, they rebid their contracts, they rewrote some of their contracts, looking for anywhere that they could do some efficiencies in there. And $312,000 of that is against the general fund, so savings directly to the general fund on that. In our human resources department, they reduced one FTE, one position, full-time equivalent. But we also then added some contract dollars in there for a retirement liaison contract. What that is that's someone to come in and actually work with our employees on their working with ASRS, our Arizona State Retirement System.
Yeah, Mayor, we found that sometimes our employees really need an ombudsman to go work with ASRS. They're not always looking after the best interest of the employee, but looking after the best interest of the fund. And we've had, that's been a concern, especially if you consider many of our employees work here for many years, decades, but they are not familiar with the financing and pensions and how that work. And we just feel it's a service that we really need to be able to provide for our employees. So,
okay.
So that one there is a reinvestment back into our employees with that particular contract amount. But they did still achieve a net savings of just over $29,000, of which almost $23,000 of that was toward savings in the general fund for those particular items. Our information technology department was able to identify over $800,000 in savings due to discontinuing our current Microsoft Enterprise agreement. Of that, $690,000 is toward the general fund. Their savings would be realized both this year and next year. They're comfortable that we don't need this particular agreement with Microsoft over the next 2 years. Over that time, they're going to look for, they'll be defining what their needs will be in 13-14. So while this is not an ongoing savings reduction, We do have a significant reduction in the general fund for the next 2 years that will be able to accommodate some of our one-time issues, as well as just kind of get us through until we can see how the economy is doing over these next 2 years. So that was a significant contribution to the budget this year. Those were the departments that had reductions that did not actually present to you. What I'd also like to do is just summarize the fees and charges that have gone through the Audit and Finance Committee, and you'll be seeing those coming forward in June for adoption, but this council as a whole has not seen those, so I just want to kind of outline what you will be seeing coming through.
There are a few more departments, aren't there?
There are a few more. This is not an all-inclusive list of every department in the state.
But the other departments didn't have any impact in their budgets.
Okay.
Correct. And one of the other attachment that you have in Legistar is an itemized list of the departments who did have savings toward the general fund. So there were other departments who made reductions, but if they were not, for example, in the gas, in our energy resources department, there were some positions that were reduced and so forth. But because they don't impact the general fund, they're not on that summary. So each department did look out through their department. They looked for savings and inefficiencies, any innovations they could do. The summary we're providing you today is just the general fund impact of those.
Okay.
On our fees and charges side, fees and charges that you can see come through, excuse me, over the next month is in our arts and cultural department. We have a request to eliminate the current fee admission for the Mesa Contemporary Arts and make that a free entry into that particular facility. They also have some changes to establish fee ranges for the Museum for Natural History and the Arizona Museum for Youth. The fiscal impact of that is a negative $5,000. That's the reduction in the admission to the contemporary arts. Okay. Business services, they have established an enforcement letter fee and an increase in the lien fee. Also establishing a new teenage dance hall fees. I believe the enforcement letter and the lien fee were discussed when they came to you. Development service. Oh.
Mr. Richards.
Just because it's on here, I'm going to make this quick comment.
Okay.
In our arts and culture, I always feel like there's something missing on the end of Mesa Contemporary Arts. What is it? Is it a museum? Is it a gallery? What is it? And it just seems like we need something there to help drive traffic so people know that it's even down in the big hole in the Mesa Arts Center.
Yeah. Vice Mayor, Councilmember Richens, MCA actually stands for the Museum of Contemporary Arts. It's a museum for contemporary arts.
Okay.
And we've been doing, if you go by there, we now have in the windows exhibits, posters and so forth, as well as huge posters that are coming actually off of the building also of the exhibits that are downstairs.
Right.
We're hoping that Mr. Friedline's retirement also there this afternoon will help promote the...
I thought you said it was contemporary arts, not fossils.
Yeah, prehistoric.
Yes, so it's just another way of promoting our venues.
It's
the Museum of Contemporary Arts, yes.
I don't think a lot of people know that because I've had a lot of comments on it from
various
people.
That's Mesa Contemporary Arts, yes. Museum of Contemporary Arts.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
A museum to the modern.
Okay, in our Development Services and Sustainability Department, Christine mentioned her fees this morning, so this is just a summary of those, her charges that she wants to recommending doing changes to as well. In our Falcon Field Airport, we do have an increase on storage room rentals and waiting list and security deposits, as well as we also have, due to council request from last year, the removal of the per tie-down discount for the 20 or more on the open tie-downs out at Falcon Field. So that'll be coming through as well, the elimination of that particular discount. Mm-hmm. Information technology also has a recommended fee rate increase for their telecommunications license application. The financial impact to 11-12 is estimated at nothing at this point just because there's so far and few and in between, but we do want that on the books so that when the next one does come through, it's there. That's kind of a summary of the fees and charges as we know them today that would be coming through to you. If there is any future movement on the environmental fee that would be coming back to you and so forth, that would also be added to that particular list of fees and charges that would come through at the end. But at this time, those are the ones that we're aware of that will be coming through to you in June for that timeline. So pulling this all together, all the different presentations that we've had over April and the recommended reductions in budgets that impact the general fund, this is really an overview here of where we stand today. What is the status of the previously forecasted two-year budget shortfall? If you recall, our forecast was $7.4 million shortfall in the general fund. We've identified department reductions or savings to the tune of one-time savings of $2.4 million, ongoing savings of $3.8 million, for a total of $6.2 million in reductions from departments. Department revenues, we had some one-time revenues come in through our mass transit. We had some local transportation assistance funds that came in that was unanticipated. And we have some ongoing. Those are the additional increases in our arts and cultural attendance, as well as the municipal court came in and spoke with you about their defensive driving increase in those fees. So those would be our ongoing revenues that we've identified. What that really gets us down to is $6.2 million in reductions, as well as $1.2 million in increased revenues. Ties out to our $7.4 million and covers our budget shortfall for the upcoming year. Budget discussions that we have remaining, we're not quite done. We're almost there, but we're getting to the end, but not quite there. So we've got a few more discussions to go through. Next week, we'll be coming back to you on Monday doing a tax collection system replacement discussion. On Thursday, we'll be coming to you with our final draft and discussion of our 11-12 utility rates. May 12th is just follow-up and discussion on any outstanding or pending items that we haven't addressed or have resolution on for the 11-12 budget. On May 16th, you'll be adopting the notice of intent to adjust utility rates. Just as a reminder, this is just a notice of intent to adjust them. It does not actually set the rates in this notice that you do on May 16th. Okay? That's just our public notice requirements. On May 19th, we're scheduled to actually receive the preliminary budget and the capital improvement program books or publications electronically, apparently. Okay. Then actual budget adoption happens in June. Okay, so the May will still continue our discussions on the budget. In June, we will actually be taking some legal action on the budget. So on June 6th, you will be asked to adopt the 11-12 tentative budget. What this does, as a reminder, sets the ceiling of our expenditures for 11-12. Our final budget cannot surpass that ceiling that you set on June 6th. We'll also be introducing our utility rate ordinances. June 27th, we'll come back and we'll conduct three different public hearings. One will be on the utility rate adjustments, as recommended, another on the capital improvement plan, and another on the final 11-12 operational budget. That night also, you'll be asked to adopt utility rate ordinances and resolutions, adopt the fees and charges resolutions, adopt the five-year capital improvement plan, and as we stated before, this is a plan. It is a five-year plan. Only the 11-12 portion of that is included in the actual adopted budget. So you'll come back every year and adjust the plan. And you'll also be asked to adopt our final 11-12 budget. Okay. And then our final note as we roll over into July, final action that we'll need is Council adopting the secondary property tax levy. And then that will actually conclude our 11-12 budget process. Are there any questions that you have for me today or that any feedback
and
or direction
that
you
July 14th vote, Mr. Brady will finally let me take my wife on a Hawaii vacation?
That is correct. We need you 2 weeks at least after you do the budget adoption.
The two are not tied together. Okay. Any questions, comments, or profanities? All right. We'll save that for later then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item number three, acknowledge receipts of minutes of various boards and committees, Transportation Advisory Board. I have a motion from Councilmember Kavanaugh, second from Councilmember Higgins. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Item four, here reports of meetings or conferences attended. I guess I will start. Three of us were gone, right? We had an interesting meeting that I watched on television with a whole four people here. Actually, three people here, and one calling in from New York, but three of us were in Seattle attending a conference through the National League of Cities that was also sponsored by two federal agencies, Treasury and Commerce. They brought in some folks from China, some businesses. There were more than two dozen businesses here, all of them interested in foreign direct investment. Mesa was selected on a competitive basis with cities all across the United States come in and listen to some presentations on how to set up foreign direct investment and have and to meet with representatives from business who are interested in establishing a relationship here. One of the strengths, or several of the strengths, that Mesa has and why we were selected is the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport has wonderful opportunities for growth and investment on and around it. Also has a military reuse zone and a foreign trade zone, all of which are very attractive to companies in Asia and Europe and other parts of the world. So if we want to grow in this community and really build it up, one of the areas that we need to focus on is foreign direct investment and creating companies that can export overseas, and that's how we create jobs and wealth here at home. One of the lessons that we learned is that these things take a lot of time, a lot of energy, and personal relationships are incredibly important. So it could take the better part of a half a decade or more of just of establishing personal relationships with the folks overseas before you start to bring in some of those businesses. So the Sister Cities program, I think, has been underutilized. I think Councilmember Cavanaugh would agree. We're going to be focusing a little bit more on our Sister Cities efforts and really trying to turn it into what it was supposed to be, which is economic development effort. So that was one of the meetings that Councilmember Cavanaugh, Councilmember Higgins, and I attended in Seattle. And I think we had some good coffee while we were there, too. So. Also, the week before that, I was in Washington, D.C. I attended another meeting, the National EMS Advisory Council. It's amazing how many things at the federal level really impact us locally. And National EMS Advisory Council is talking about accreditation of programs and certification and licensure of paramedics. So what's decided at the federal level could impact us down the road here. So I've been trying to stay involved in that. My pancake breakfast, thank you very much. The day before Easter, which was not lost on my wife, who thought I was absolutely insane, but the day I wanted was taken by Councilmember Cavanaugh. Thanks, Dennis. Seniority works. So much for titles. So he will be having one and that coming up day after tomorrow, and I had mine this last week. It tremendous success for being the day before Easter. We had a lot of people come out very interested in the projects that are going on in there, First Solar and some of the other items that were happening. So who else? Dennis?
I'd like to report on another event on Saturday. The mayor and I attended the annual fundraiser golf tournament for Mesa Sister Cities. And it was, I think, a very successful event that has grown throughout the years. Great corporate sponsors. It's the major fundraising event for Sister Cities, which will allow us to help grow that program and hopefully, again, move into more of an economic development focus for the city to partner with Mesa Sister Cities. And so I'd like to just congratulate all the volunteers who worked so hard to make that a success. Thank you.
Last weekend, Longbow, one of the lovely golf courses in Mesa, was host to the Arizona Junior Golf Association tournament, a four-day event, the Heather Farr Classic, where over 100 young golfers that make you believe you really can't play golf when you can see how well they hit the ball in their 13 through 18-year-olds. Tournament at Longwood was wonderful, hundreds and hundreds of fans, and it's just a great event right there here in Mesa. So, you know, look over on that golf side of the business and come watch. I think the next thing is the WAC tournament, the Women's WAC. Western Athletic Conference has their championships at Longbow, too, and it's just a lot of fun to come watch great golf locally. Thanks.
Anything else? Dave?
I just wanted to thank one of my neighborhoods in the far east part of my council district, north of Hermosa, west of Hermosa Vista, and west of Lindsay. Just people forget that's part of District 1, but they put together an event called April in the Park. And because the firefighters were busy cooking breakfast for Councilmember Summers, I wanted to thank my son, my 11-year-old son, and my father-in-law who came and helped me cook pancakes for 150 people that morning. And so I had my apron on, and my son was cooking sausage. He did a great job. I just wanted to thank my son, Nate, for the great job he did on that one. And for the neighborhood group, it was a great event. Senator Crandall was there, and Matt Salmon was there, and talking to everybody about city stuff. And generally, the neighborhood is really happy with the way the city's being run. So kudos to my colleagues. Thanks.
And I would be remiss if I failed to mention we had a Building Strong Neighborhoods meeting we're doing. This is the fifth year in a row. This is the fifth one in District 6. Really, really impressive turnout in that neighborhood, and they're very excited to have us along helping them out. So, Mr. Brady, future meetings?
Yes, just
general information, perhaps you have some?
Yes, I do. First of all, as we were previously mentioned, Councilman Kavanaugh will be having pancake breakfast this Saturday at the Rose Junior High, which is also home of the Flow Rider, and so I think that will be open for free rides. So that event goes from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. This Saturday. Our next study session and council meeting will be Monday, May 2nd. We also have coming up on Saturday, May 7th, City Hall at the Mall. We'll be at Fiesta Mall, and we'll also be featuring iMesa there. We have an opportunity to interact with iMesa. And as Christine mentioned earlier, we invite the council, if you have time today, to come down to meet with the consultants on the form-based code in room 170, so they're set up down there. And then finally, just a kind of a personal note, I want to take this time to thank Jack Friedline for his service with the city. Today is Jack's, not only his last study session, but his last day working with the city of Mesa. Very distinguished career, not just here in Mesa, but our suburb to the west, city of Phoenix. And he also had quite a career also in Buffalo, New York. So we want to thank Jack for his service and leadership and really making contributing to this organization over many years. So thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. I wanted to tell you what an honor it was to serve the city and thank the guidance of this council and past councils. You've done a great job. And over 12 years, I've broken this chair in for anybody who wants to come to the big kids' table anytime they want.
That's a very kind comment that you made, unlike Christine Zalanka, who decided to diss me. We love you, Christine.
Sometimes.
Anything else, Mr. Brady? Very good. Items for citizen present. Any requests to speak?
No requests, Vice Mayor.
No requests. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. I have a... Everybody to the right of me has decided that we're going to adjourn. So anybody opposed? Didn't think so. We're adjourned. Thank you.